Overwhelmed by investing?
If you're anything like us, the hardest part is getting started. That's why we created the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Our goal is to help simplify money so it can work for you.
We invite guests to demystify investing.
At least try to be setting aside like the minimum 10% into the 401k.
We'll teach you the basics of the market.
Yeah, I think compound interest should be at the start of any discussion about investing. And
we've had investment professionals who teach in a simple way.
A valuation-driven bear market. You know, we haven't really seen yet, and I think everyone's thinking about it, but we haven't really seen yet.
Our Q&A episodes feature questions from listeners just like you.
So what do you think about the situation with ETBI, which is Activision?
I'm Dave Ahern.
And I'm Andrew Sather.
And we hope you join us on the Investing for Beginners podcast.
On the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Hey, do you have trouble sleeping? Then maybe you should check out the Sleepy Podcast. It's a show where I read old books in the public domain to help you get to sleep. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of classic stories like A Tale of Two Cities, Pride and Prejudice, Winnie the Pooh. Stories that are great for adults and kids alike. For years now, Sleepy has helped millions of people catch some much-needed Z's, start their next day off fresh, and discover old books that they didn't know they loved. So, whether you have a tough time snoozing or you just like a good bedtime story, fluff up the cool side of your pillow and tune into Sleepy. Unless you're driving, then please don't listen to Sleepy. Find Sleepy on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes each week. Sweet dreams.
We all enjoy a little mystery. Every other week, One Strange Thing presents forgotten stories from America's newspaper archives. They all have something in common, a single element that can't quite be explained. Join us on One Strange Thing, and you'll hear about a man who was literally stricken with genius. A 21st century child who remembered piloting a World War II bomber. A mysterious, unidentifiable blob in Texas. And then there was the lizard man stalking through small-town South Carolina. From cryptids and disappearances to modern-day miracles, One Strange Thing brings you stories that are very real and just a little otherworldly. Subscribe now, wherever you listen.
What Was That Like? Contains adult language and content and is not intended for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to What Was That Like? I'm your host, Scott Johnson. This is the show where we talk to regular people, people just like you or just like me, who have found themselves in an extremely unusual situation. We'll hear their stories and get inside their head because we all want to know, what was that like? More information about each episode at whatwasthatlike.com. Here we go. Vincent lives and works in Chicago as a photojournalist. He takes a lot of pictures, and a lot of those pictures include crime scenes. In his line of work, he's used to getting the call and going to where the news is happening. But there was one night when he didn't have to go anywhere. The crime scene was just outside his front door. That was the night 17-year-old Michael Patton was gunned down during a thunderstorm. Vincent heard the shots and ran outside while his wife called 911. The teenager had been shot in the chest and in the head, and he died while Vincent held his hand. We talked about Vincent's perspective on this experience, both as a photographer and journalist, and as a father. An experience like this is certainly something that none of us ever wants to go through. If you'd like to contact Vincent or see some of his photography, you can do so by checking out a project he's currently working on called Lost Americana. You can see that at lostamericana.com. Vincent also wrote an article for the Chicago Sun-Times about this incident. I'll have a link to that in the show notes for this episode at whatwasthatlike.com/07. And now here's my conversation with Vincent. All right, Vincent, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, I'm glad to be here.
I know, and we're going to talk about this a little bit. You are a photojournalist. Have you, in your work, have you ever witnessed a death before?
You know, I haven't seen death up close in my work like this. I've been to crime scenes before. There's definitely been places where I, you know, was at a shooting or a fire and somebody had passed away. But usually getting this close to, a body, I guess, is not something that's, you know, normal. I mean, you know, police tape's usually pretty far back, in this situation, it just happened to be my front doorstep. So it was kind of hard to push me back any farther than I already was.
Exactly. Yeah. Before we get into actually what happened that night, can you tell us a little bit about your neighborhood? What's that like? What's your street like?
My street, at the time it was pretty quiet. It's still pretty quiet. I don't live on that block anymore. I still live in the same neighborhood. So I didn't leave because of this. I'm actually farther into my neighborhood. I was on the outskirts of it now. It's a working class African-American neighborhood for the most part. It's called Bronzeville. It's on the south side of Chicago. That's where I live. It's a little quiet, tree-lined, one-way street that, you know, doesn't get much traffic. You know, the middle of the day, you know, middle of the afternoon on a week, parking is real easy to get there because, you know, everybody's at work. You know, it's not the, you know, you hear a lot about the south side, and it's not the same south side that, you know, is on, you know, the nightly news when we have a spree of murders or something like that.
You know, you hear a lot about Chicago and, you know, I'm in Florida. I've been to Chicago a few years ago, but you hear a lot about the so much violence and gunfire and everything. Are people there kind of a mentality or a constant state of fear, or what's the mentality of living in that area?
You know, I mean, here's the thing. There's roughly the south side of Chicago is huge. And Chicago just in general is huge. I mean, it's the third largest city population wise area. I don't know how big it is, but it's not like everybody makes it out to be. There's, like I said, it's a working class. A lot of people are there. They're going to their jobs during the day. There's employment is pretty good. You know, what happens is there's roughly, and statistically, I'm not on the police payroll, so I don't know about this, but it's been said that there's about 8 neighborhoods out of like the 55 neighborhoods in the city that are contributing about 75% of the homicides or crime. And I'm not in one of those neighborhoods. Now, a couple of those neighborhoods are on the south side, a few more of them are on the far west side of Chicago. And that's where most of the, you know, the murders and the shootings are happening, and it's all targeted gang related. So, you know, on a daily basis, no, I walk in and out of my house. I walk up and down my block. I mean, I grew up outside of the city. I have a blonde white mother who will walk around with a stroller pushing my kids through the neighborhood. And, you know, she's not fearful. And once you come here and you kind of see it and you know the people who live in the block, yeah, you know, it's not this crime ridden. I never worry about getting mugged or, you know, robbed or anything like that. I mean, I do worry about it. You can't live in a big city like this and not worry about something like that. But like, it's not a constant fear that I have. And this is coming from, you know, a white guy in a predominantly black neighborhood. And the other thing I like to tell people is you'll hear stuff about shootings that happen. Like, oh, aren't you worried? There was this, you know, like 12 people got shot over the weekend. Or, you know, I think this last weekend was pretty bad. We had like 64 shootings. And I think it was 12 people that died 2 weekends ago. And yeah, but like some of the majority of those are happening down in, say, like the 111th block. And I'm roughly at 50th, which is going to put you, I mean, it's a difference between somebody being worried about crime downtown Chicago when they live in like the far north burbs. The south side of Chicago folded over is so big that you would literally, you know, a crime like that is, it's like talking about crime in another city and being worried that it's coming to your neighborhood. So I mean, there's shootings that happen in my neighborhood, obviously. That's why I'm on this podcast. But, you know, there's shootings that happen in other parts of the city. And, you know, I'm more worried about, you know, my sons hanging out at a friend's house and their parents have a gun than I am worried about them getting shot on the street right now. That's more of a concern.
Yeah, it's like probably in any large city with that many people, there's certain areas that you want to avoid just from common sense, because that's where bad stuff happens.
Yeah. And there's a whole podcast there about, you know, why it is just that area or why these particular areas. But no, exactly. It was just some places like, you know, if you don't have business there, and, you know, if you're walking around looking like a victim, chances are you're going to get turned into a victim sometimes. But yeah, for the most part, if you know, living in this neighborhood on the South Side, and there's a bunch of neighborhoods like that on the South Side that, you know, and it's been great because it's allowed us, I think, to stay in the city and live in a bigger house than I think some of our friends on the North Side could have ever lived in, because it's the value for property versus what you have. I mean, we can go out and do a lot around here, and it's, you know, it's nice.
All right. Well, let's talk about what happened that night. If you can just kind of take us through that. I understand there was a pretty bad storm happening. Is that right?
Yeah. So it was the end of June. We had just had my oldest son's fifth birthday party earlier that day. And so we were kind of still cleaning up the house, and it was a cool night. It was, you know, it wasn't, you know, it was still June in Chicago. So, you know, let's be honest, it could have snowed if we were lucky. And so we had the windows open. There was a good breeze coming through, and the breeze was coming through nicely because there was a storm rolling in. And the storm hit, and it was coming from the north, from what I remember. So we had closed the windows in the back of the house, which faced north, but the front windows, which are south facing, were still open because the rain was not even coming in. It was blowing in the opposite direction, so we had no problem. And I had been walking, I think, down into the basement or down to the first floor, and I had heard this giant, like, crack, crack, crack noise. And we have a tree that's out in our front yard, and I thought maybe, because the wind was really gusting, that, you know, it had broke a branch and then, it, you know, fell down. And I was like, well, my truck's parked underneath there. I'm going to look out the window and make sure that, you know, my truck didn't get smashed or, you know, that nothing's going on. And then, but there was no tree branch in the gutter laying on the street. There was, however, a body of what I thought was a man laying on his back in essentially a puddle of water, a giant puddle, because like I said, it had been raining torrentially that night.
And he was there by himself?
Yeah, at the time he was there by himself, and I had saw somebody else that was running across through a neighbor's yard. They had to hop two fences, one to get into the yard and then the other to, you know, get out of the yard into the alley behind their house. And they were yelling for help, and they were saying, like, my brother's been shot. And, you know, that helped me piece together what was going on really quick. Like, he didn't get struck by lightning. He didn't get hit by a tree branch, you know, or hit by a car. He, you know, the person that I saw laying out there was shot. And, you know, so my first thing I did was I went back to my closet. I grabbed actually a photographic, like, weatherproof raincoat that I have that, you know, has all sorts of pockets for photography stuff, a flashlight. And, you know, I went out there barefoot. I mean, I was getting ready for bed. I was in some, like, gym shorts and a t-shirt. So I went out and started, you know, went up to what I found out later would be a 17-year-old kid, and was just kind of checking him out with a flashlight, you know, trying to talk to him, like, you know, checking his pulse on his wrist and then his neck. And I wasn't really getting anything.
You didn't call 911 already?
So I didn't call 911. That was actually my wife who was calling. She had saw it, and, you know, I went out and she made the call.
How did she realize what was going on? Did you tell her what you saw, or?
She was right next to the window. She was in her bedroom, which had the windows open. So when she heard it, the sound didn't echo throughout the house like it did for me. And she knew right away that it was gunshots.
Oh, okay.
So I came up talking about, like, a tree branch, and she's looking at me like, what are you, dumb? Like, that was gunshots. Like, clearly that was gunshots.
Listen up, true crime fans.
There's a big murder trial underway.
Dateline is launching a new podcast with Andrea Canning.
Welcome to Dateline True Crime Weekly.
We'll cover breaking crime news around the country with the best reporters on the case, NBC News analysts, and Dateline producers on the ground.
Over. Break it down for us.
You'll get behind-the-scenes scoops from crime scenes to courtrooms.
So tell us what he said.
Listen to Dateline True Crime Weekly now and catch new episodes every Thursday.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
I'll confess, sometimes I let my podcast playlist get out of hand and I get way behind. But there's one show that I subscribe to and any new episode goes right to the top of the queue. That's the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's because I never have to figure out, okay, is this one going to be interesting or do I wait for the next one like I do for some shows? Because Jordan's conversations are always a must-listen for me. He talks to fascinating people from any category you can think of. Authors, scientists, athletes, you name it. He's talked to undercover cops who posed as mafia and the actual career mafia hitmen. And the stories he gets out of these people, just incredible. In one episode, he talked to Paul Holes. You might know that name if you're into true crime. He's the former investigator who uses really advanced methods to solve cold cases, including the Golden State Killer. And another one I really enjoyed was with Sam Harris, an author and neuroscientist who promotes skepticism, and he doesn't mind taking on some seriously controversial topics like politics or religion. That one's going to make you think. Whenever a new episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show pops up, I already know it's going to be an episode that I'll enjoy listening to, and I'll bet you will too. For some episode recommendations, check out jordanharbinger.com/start. Or search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Or what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the hosts of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field. And we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
So yeah, then I was like, you know, there was a body, and I think she could see it out of the window where I was, you know, I was on the first floor, you know, kind of yelling down to her. And so I went out the door after I turned off. We had a home alarm on. So I turned that off and went out there, and then she was making the call. And I remember she's always had this recurring nightmare where she calls 911 because something, you know, whatever bad is happening. And she just gets on hold, or like the phone just keeps ringing. And I think she had said it went up to like 19 rings that night before she actually got through to 911. So she was in this whole thing where like, there's this body of a person out in front of our house. I'm calling 911. It's nighttime and it's not going through. And she really had to question whether or not like this was really happening or if she was in a nightmare.
Wow.
Yeah. So a little bit surreal.
Man. Okay. So you went outside. And it's still pouring rain.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's absolutely just, it's a downpour. The wind, I think maybe it died down a little bit at that point, but not even, because I mean, like I said, I just thought a tree branch cracked. So, but you know, how the weather was at that point was not really in my mind. I just knew it was wet and I needed a raincoat. But like I said, I didn't even put shoes on. So I was literally waiting in, like, it was ankle deep water because it's a one-way street, so there's literally only enough room for one car to go down kind of at a time, and then cars are parked on the left and right, and that little parking area where, you know, the gutters usually and everything drains was full with, it was ankle deep water. I mean, there was that much water that night, and it had been coming down for so long that, you know, it had just built up, and he was floating in the water for the most part. Like his legs were a little bit out, but like his back and his head were, you know, kind of bobbing up and down a little bit in the water, and he started to gasp for air, you know, right around the time that I was checking his pulse, because he really wasn't moving. And, you know, then he started gasping. And at that point, you know, I'm like, okay, well, this guy's shot. And I think my wife had grabbed some towels, and she might have been looking for, because she's in medicine. So she has, you know, one of those like respirator, I forget what they call it, but for mouth to mouth. And she was looking for some rubber gloves too, which I don't think she found either of, you know, in the rush that night, because, you know, I think there are more in her car, but either way, it's, you know, it's not something you're expecting on a daily basis.
No, but so she was thinking about what needed to be done, what were you doing at that time while you were there?
Well, I will say, and this is where the, you know, the photojournalism kind of kicked in. Like the first thing I thought when I walked outside my door and I saw this body was, there's this click that goes into my head where I'm like, oh, this is a crime scene. This is news.
And, you know, my first thought is like, do I grab my camera and start photographing this? Because this is news. This is my job. This is kind of what I do, where she's like getting ready to like try to save somebody. I'm like, do I take pictures of this? And I had a really great photojournalism teacher in college. His name was John H. White. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning photojournalist. Used to shoot for the Chicago Sun-Times. And he, you know, had this thing where he's like, look, there's going to be times in your career where you have to be human first, and then you're a journalist second, and then you're a photographer third. So, you know, it's, you got to go out there, and if you're the only one there and somebody needs help, it's not your job to report on it or take pictures of it. It's your job to kind of help. And that's kind of what that turned out. I don't even think I looked back. I just, the thought process took me about as long as it did to explain it here in my head. Mm-hmm. But that process, you know, because your brain works so quick, was pretty fast. And
right,
so
right.
I had paused maybe for like a half second and then made my way down the stairs and went out and immediately kind of started checking for the pulse, grabbing his hand, telling him like, hey, the police are on their way. You know, the ambulance is on the way, man. You just need to hold through, you know, hang on there. And at that point is when when the other guy that was with him came back, and so did a female friend of theirs.
Okay. And what was their involvement? You said at the beginning, someone said they shot my brother. Was this the brother?
That is the one part that, you know, I've talked to this person. His name is Michael Patton, the man who was, or the kid who was shot. He was a foster child. So the person, the other guy that was there was not, I think, an actual blood brother, but, you know, I don't know what the relationship was. I never knew anything about this kid before or after this. You know, I never even knew the kid that was shot. Like, he wasn't somebody that I was familiar with from the neighborhood.
Okay.
But he came back, and the only thing that I've learned since then, and obviously because I was right there, was whoever this kid was, he was also there with Michael when the shooting happened, because he was the one who ran away, and then he was the one who came back. The girl, I don't remember. And I just remember, so I'm standing there, and it was one of those things. And if there's one thing I regret about the whole situation, is while I was standing there holding his hand and like telling him to hang out, and, you know, I'd started to unzip his shirt. He had like a fleece hoodie on or something like that. And I was opening it up to kind of see where he was shot and see if we could kind of stop any bleeding. You know, his friend kept walking back and forth, like, you know, they shot my brother, you know, just kind of, he was almost in like a state of shock, which I'm assuming, you know, between your friend just getting shot, and also I believe the kid was shot as well. He was grazed in the arm. You know, I'm sure the adrenaline and your brain starts going in separate directions. And so, yeah, the only thing I could really say, you know, he came up, and one of the first things he did when he got back, which kind of upset me a little bit, but he came back and there was $20 bills that were floating in the water next to them. So he had picked up some of that money and then was kind of going back and forth with the, you know, they shot my brother. But back to the one thing I regret was, while I was there holding his hand, there was a part of me that was, I wanted to tell this kid, like, hey, this is your brother. Like, you need to come down here and talk to him, because he might not make it. He needs to hear your voice. You need to kind of say your piece just in case this doesn't, you know, end the way we hope it does. And, you know, I never kind of went up and like said that to him. I kind of stayed there and focused on the kid, because it was clearly nobody else was.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I think some of the neighbors had started to come out, and the rain had died down just a little bit, but, you know, there started to be a crowd that was gathering.
And your wife was on, was she still on with 911? I mean, were they telling her to do CPR or?
Yeah, she came out at that point. And I, you know, he was, like I said, he was still breathing a little bit, gasping mostly. She had come out with some towels and bandages and stuff that we had. But, you know, like I said, when I had opened the wound, you know, opened up his shirt and saw, he basically had the best way to describe it is, it looked like a belly button. He had like a new belly button somewhere around like his left side of his chest, if I'm correct. And it was just this like fleshy white part of his skin that you could see where the bullet went in. So there's a really good possibility, and this is something that's always kind of haunted my wife a little bit, that he was sitting there in that pool of water, and if he had an exit wound on the back end, and every time he's gasping, there's a good possibility that he might have drowned before he actually died of anything else. Although the one kind of solace my wife has in not feeling bad about that is that apparently he also had a bullet wound to the head. So it said one to the chest in the police report and one to the head as well. And he had kind of short, medium length, kind of tight curls, on his hair. So, we were looking for a secondary, we had looked at his head too, just to make sure that he wasn't shot there. But never saw any kind of bullet wound up there. So wherever it was, like I said, it was dark. Everything was wet, which made everything even darker, and it washed away any kind of blood. There was literally no blood out there until the next morning when the sun came out, and you could see where the body was laying from the night before, because the water had started to drain later in the evening when the ambulance came about 4 or 5 minutes later.
So even if you would have seen an exit wound on his back, there's really no place to pull him or drag him to that would be dry.
You could have dragged. Well, he was in a pool of water. I mean, he was in at least a good 3 inches of water. So we could have dragged him up onto the grass.
Okay.
Which, or dragged him further out into the street either way. But, like I said, when, we had 3, maybe 4 minutes out there with him before the paramedics showed up. So it's,
And you're not an EMT.
No, and I'm not an EMT, and she's not an EMT either. She works in dermatology, so she's used to if he had a rash, she would have, she'd have been really good at treating his rash or, psoriasis, but, bullet wounds, she worked as a nurse, for training in an emergency room back when she was, in college. But at that point, I think it was maybe a decade before. So
now in what you wrote about this, I seem to recall that by the time the ambulance and the police got there, he had already died.
Yeah, that was pretty much it. I mean, I think like I said, there was some time when I was there, I wasn't holding his hand the entire time. Obviously there was some other things I was doing. I went back in the house at one point to get something else and then, or tell my wife hey, grab this. I know one of the first neighbors that showed up was in the apartment building that was right next to me. And I had already looked up when I went out there, probably about 30 seconds after I was out there, and I was holding his hand. And I was looking around because, somebody just got shot. And so I'm not a cop or, I've never been in the army, but I'm pretty well aware that the most dangerous place to be is around, right after somebody got shot. Cause you never know. Was the guy that left that said, is he coming back with a gun for retribution?
Right.
Is the person who shot this kid coming back to make sure that they did the job? And so I'm looking around to make sure that, whatever happens, I'm well protected at the same time.
Well, that's the first thing when, in EMT training, that's the first thing they tell you when you're approaching a scene. Your first question is the scene safe? Because if it's not safe, they're not going to go in. They're going to let the police go in first.
And that is, there was part of me when I was, like I said, my first thing was not, is it safe? My first thing is, do I take a picture? My second thing was no, okay, I got to help somebody. And then somewhere along those lines was am I going to be okay out here? And I was the only one on the block. I was the first one out there because like I said, his friend had left and it was just me and this kid in the rain.
Now, at some point in this scenario, you noticed a gun lying on the ground.
I was about ready to get to that. Yeah. And that's when I was saying the guy from the apartment, he came out and I was like, Daryl, I'm like, stand over that gun. I'm like, nobody touches that. And he's a bigger guy. So he's probably about 6 foot, 220 pounds. I was just like, nobody touches that gun. I didn't know if it was the one that shot him. I didn't know, what it was. Apparently the story goes that it was his gun and it had jammed. So, the whole backstory of this is, unfortunately, what happened was he was a foster kid. He, actually grew up in a pretty decent suburb, or at least he graduated from high school in a pretty decent suburb of Chicago. And he had just relocated with a new foster parent or something like that, I guess for his last year or last 6 months. And, he had been in and out of trouble, but they thought he was kind of out of it. But she was a little bit older and wasn't able to kind of control a 17-year-old boy like you should be able to. And so he had been out apparently sticking up the weed man. And I don't know if you know what the weed man is, but that's the person that you call up to, come and hand deliver your drugs to you now. It's not, you don't go to houses anymore to do it. They drive around in cars with like a small little amount. So if they do get pulled over, they don't do any serious jail time. And so you call this guy up and he came out and they had been robbing, you know, this person or other people, I guess, other weed men in the neighborhood. And so this time, you know, he decided to do it, I guess, in the middle of a rainstorm, and these people were ready for him. And so he tried to stick him up and somebody shot him from the back of what I believe was a minivan, from the all accounts of the friend that was there.
Let's face it, money is the one subject we all need to deal with, but no one actually wants to talk about. The good news is there's a podcast helping you learn everything about money no one taught you. Meet Everyone's Talkin' Money, hosted by me, Shauna Game. Everyone's Talkin' Money focuses on relevant, inclusive, and forward-thinking conversations around money and just helps you get in a better relationship with your money no matter what your goals are. Do yourself a favor and subscribe to Everyone's Talkin' Money podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Imagine unlocking a version of yourself that's unstoppable, where mental barriers no longer hold you back. Listen to Mentally Stronger with me, Amy Morin, therapist and international bestselling author, here to guide you on a journey to reaching your greatest potential. Every Monday, I bring you into conversations with some of the most fascinating minds, experts, authors, entrepreneurs, athletes, and musicians. They don't just share stories, they reveal the mental strategies that propelled them to the top. But here's the real magic. At the end of each episode, I break down their wisdom into practical therapist-approved advice. In my solo episodes, I dive deep into the techniques that build mental strength. It's like having your own personal therapy session as you discover how to turn these insights into steps you can take right now. This podcast isn't just for those facing mental health challenges. It's for anyone who wants to push their limits, achieve peak performance, and truly thrive. Are you ready to unlock your full potential? Then it's time to become mentally stronger. Subscribe to Mentally Stronger with therapist Amy Morin, available wherever you love to listen to podcasts.
And yeah, that's how it went down. He basically tried to stick him up. They shot him, and now he's dead, unfortunately.
So in reading some of the news stories, I didn't know any of that backstory. It seemed more like it was just like a random drive-by or maybe gang related retribution shooting or something like that. But this was just over some marijuana money, sounds like.
Pretty much. And that's what I said. Like, that's why, you know, when I went out there, the kid was floating in the water, you know, gasping for air, and there was a bunch of $20 bills floating around him. So he had either just decided to rob them, or, you know, I'm not entirely sure how it, you know, that all went down, but that's the word on the street from some of the neighbors that I heard was that he was trying to stick up the weed guy, and the weed guy got him and, you know, almost got his friend too. So,
wow. Of course, that's not the results of an official police investigation. So, you know, who knows if that's accurate or not, but
sure. This is, I will say that, that is rumor speculation from the neighborhood, but I will also say the neighborhood is usually pretty spot on. So, it's
certainly a viable explanation. Yeah.
It's it seems to be, they've been an accurate source on more than one occasion for things that have happened.
The word on the street. Yeah.
The word on the street.
Do you know anything about what happened afterward, or have you talked to anyone that was maybe directly involved as part of his family or anything?
What I did have is a couple of months after the article was written, and it was, you know, it's a front page article on the Sun Times. It, you know, it got a little bit of attention. So, I'd had some people that would, you know, got in touch with me. I think a local alderman had written to me, you know, through email about it. I had a woman who had done a book of poems about shooting victims in the city. So she had gone around and talked to people who had, known the victims before they were shot. And she published this book of poems. And she had actually sent me a copy of the book because she had written one about Michael based on the article that I wrote. And the other thing that happened was, is he had an aunt that I believe was from Ohio who got my number somehow. She might have got my email and I gave her my number. I can't quite remember. We had a lengthy conversation and I kind of filled her in on, you know, she wanted to know like exactly what happened, you know, what were his last moments like? Cause you know, she remembered him as a baby, and I think it was her sister's
child, you know, and I'm not entirely sure. I think her mom, you know, I'm not going to go into whatever. It's a fuzzy conversation about what her mother or what happened to his mother. But, you know, he, you know, so she, you know, it was her nephew and, you know, she was really sad and she just wanted to know what really happened. Like, what was it like, you know, and she was very grateful that she knew that he died and that somebody that me and my wife were there when he passed. And that's one thing I do want to say too. I know often because I'm the journalist and I'm the one that writes the story, a lot of people forget my wife was there for a lot of this too. So like I was standing by his side and she was there for a lot of it too.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just me.
Right. So the aunt that called, it was mainly for closure for her.
Yeah.
It sounds like. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I've got a couple of nieces and nephews now too. I have a younger sister that's got kids and I would be really devastated if one of them had passed and, you know, my sister wasn't around to kind of take care of them. I would need that closure as well.
Right. Looking back on this, is there anything that you would have done differently?
You know, not really. Like I said, the only regret I really had is that I never told his friend that, like, you need to come down here, because I could see from the situation that it was a good chance he wasn't going to pull through, even if the ambulance got there in like the next 30 seconds. You know, this the bullet wound that I saw in his chest was close enough to his heart that, and I could just tell by the way this kid, I mean, he never closed his eyes. He was lying on his back, staring up, and the rain was coming down, and I don't think he blinked at all. I mean, it was just, he, you know, I think I said somewhere in the article, it was almost like he was scared to close his eyes, but, you know, there's a possibility he never heard a word that I said. I mean, he could have been just, you know, barely functioning on, like, you know, a body level at that point, like just kind of instinct or, you know, your what's left of your brain taking over and trying to, like, you know, pull you through. Cause I guess, you know, the police report said that he was shot in the head too. And I never saw that. So he didn't have like a gaping bullet wound in his head, but, you know, it seemed like he was there, but, you know, you never know.
Yeah. You know, seeing something like this personally up close, you're a father, you have kids. Has this changed your outlook on life in any way?
You know, I want to say yes, but I kind of had the outlook before. I mean, if you pay attention in life, there's too many people that have something bad happen to them. And, you know, even since, you know, like I said, it was my son's fifth birthday party at that point. And, you know, there's stories that I'd heard. There was a one that really stuck with me, I think, when he was little, was that there was a local, not local, but like in the Chicago area, there was a daycare that had a child who, you know, he was crying and being like really upset or whatever. And I guess the daycare worker just got like really fed up with him kind of having his little tantrums or whatever. And then, you know, kind of pick him up and like shook him and like threw him down to the ground or something like that. And he stopped crying and kind of whimpered. And I remember the story of this, and I don't know if they got it from the video or from a personal account, but he picked up his favorite teddy bear. He went over into like his little sleeping area, like where they were supposed to lay down and go to bed. And then he died. And, you know, from like some sort of like brain crack, you know, like some sort of something that happened to his brain. And it was just, so every day that I have with my kids, same with my wife, like they leave the house and it's morbid, but I act like they might not come back every time. And, you know, that's kind of how I've always lived. So this didn't change that too much, but it really put it front and center, I think, in one of those things. I mean, you just, you know, it's watching somebody die right there in front of you. I mean, I've been around people who have died before, but I think this was the first time, this is definitely the first time that I was holding somebody's hand. I mean, I've seen people, you know, it's not the first dead body I've seen, that's for sure, but it's the first time somebody's physically expired while I was standing next to them.
Yeah, it really, when you I'm sure probably later that night after everything had died down, you really have to think, wow, what just happened, you know?
And I did. It was, and that's where the photos came in. I mean, that's part of how the story came about. I mean, it was, you know, it happened about 10:30 at night, 10:45, I think by 11:15, you know, like I said, the police showed up about 5, you know, minutes after, you know, the, we called 911, and, it, you know, they started putting up the police tape, and it was really surreal. I mean, I remember being in almost a numb state. I was very calm during it. I kind of go into like action mode when things starts hitting the fan. It's just part of who I am. But the come down afterwards, like the, I wouldn't want to call it post-traumatic stress or anything like that, but there was definitely, there was some shock and awe of what had just happened. And I reconciled with that by going and doing what I'm used to doing, which is I went, picked up my camera. I opened my front window, stepped out of my front porch, and I started taking pictures of a crime scene. And I put myself back in that photojournalism thing instead of, you know, somebody who had just held the hand of a person who had just died. And I think the lens helped me put the closure on that situation where, you know, I don't know if I had just been a normal person, I think it still might haunt me to this day. But that camera put me on the other side of what I just went through. And I think that, you know, it was like instant therapy in a way.
You know, I hear something like this. I think you got to give credit to law enforcement, because what is so traumatic for you and I, it's just another day at work for them, especially in a city or a large population where this kind of thing happens all the time. It's
hard. I mean, it's you know, I know one of the things that, you know, I'd advocate for is I've heard police officers who have picked up like the day shift because somebody was on vacation after working the night shift, and they go back into the neighborhood and it's a completely different neighborhood to them. Hmm. There's new people they see. It's more vibrant. It's more alive. And, you know, but because of unions and seniority, sometimes the guys, you know, they work those night shifts first before they get the nice day shift that where the crime doesn't happen. And I think it really hardens you after a while. And so it's a tough gig. And, you know, it's, you know, I don't want to sit here and try to tell anybody how to do their job. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, before we wrap it up here, as a photojournalist, you've got a project you're working on. And so I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, besides going out and shooting, you know, news stories for, you know, the papers and magazines, you know, in the city, one of the things that I've been doing for going on 23 years now is I've been doing a documentary project where I kind of get away from the city, and I'm out in rural America. I've been documenting basically the abandoning of rural America, essentially population decline in small towns, specifically when it comes to like farming and ranching areas, and about how, you know, essentially since the end of World War II, there's been this kind of mass exodus from a lot of these areas, and there's slowly but surely they are, you know, kind of fading away. And it's called Lost Americana. It's, you know, it started off as just me taking pictures of like old abandoned barns because I thought they were, you know, with the sunsets and the farm fields, that they were pretty. But then the journalist in me kicked in, and I started asking questions about why they were out there. And the Lost Americana project, it covers a lot of that, you know, what's going on. And I've got a pretty regular Instagram feed, and I kind of blog on lostamericana.com about, you know, some of the stuff I see and why this is happening. And, you know, then always the biggest question is there a way to stop it from happening, which is sadly, possibly no. But yeah, that's kind of like my side project, my baby.
So people can find that at, the website is lostamericana.com.
That's correct. And just about any social media, if you just do the at Lost Americana or / Lost Americana, all one word, you know, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, it all shows up there. I've tried to kind of make sure I lock down the name so nobody else steals it and starts something else on me.
Right, right. Cool. All right. So if someone wants to contact you, that's the best way they can get in touch with you, is going through that website.
Yeah. Yep. Lostamericana.com.
All right. All right, Vincent. Well, what a traumatic thing to go through and to witness something like this. But at least you were there, and later on were able to document it. And the pictures that you took, or some of the pictures that you took of the scene, will be on the in the show notes for this when this goes live, so people can go there and see that, as well as the link to your project. And thanks again. Thanks very much for sharing your story.
Not a problem, Scott. Thanks for taking me on. It was interesting to talk about again.
Thanks for listening to this episode. My goal for each show is to introduce you to people and stories that you just won't find on other podcasts. If you want to help support the show, you just need to subscribe, and that way you'll never miss an episode. You can click on any of the subscribe buttons on the website, which is whatwasthatlike.com. You'll see all the links right there at the top where you can subscribe directly to this show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Google Play Music, Spotify, Stitcher Radio, or on whatever app you use to catch your podcasts. And you'll see there are also links to Twitter and Instagram, so you can follow us there, and I hope you do. And if you really want to connect with me and get in on the discussion with other listeners to this show, you can join our private Facebook group. You can find that at whatwasthatlike.com/Facebook. And of course, you can always email me directly at scott@whatwasthatlike.com, or just go to the website and click on contact. I'd love to hear what you think of this episode or a previous episode. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you on the next show where we'll once again ask the question, what was that like? Hey, this is Scott. Did you know we offer a premium feed of this show that is completely ad-free and there are bonus episodes? Go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus or just click the link in the show notes of any episode to learn more and to sign up. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, you can sign up right there in the app by clicking try free at the top of the episode list. And I hope to see you in the premium feed soon.